What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Two Woke Nerds podcast. I am your host, Raymond Summerlin, and I'm joined, as I am every week, by my very own chocolate bear, Mr. Gerald Goodridge. What's up, G?
What's up, Ray? Your hair is looking awfully nice today. You've got like a comb-over thing going.
I got it cut today. I'm going straight hipster with the undercut with the comb-over. I got clean lines on the side. I had them no fade. I had them just stick that line right in there, you know, like we used to do back in the hood. So I'm feeling it. I'm feeling it now. We're going to go to a rooftop bar and drink some mixologist drink and wear my Vans and talk about my book that I'm writing. It's going to be an exciting night.
Wow. That sounds fantastic.
Sounds like I'm not doing any of those things, but I thought that's what hipsters do.
I feel like I've seen you wear Vans at least once, though.
I do have Vans. I wear exclusively Pumas or Vans because I'm apparently European and hipster.
They're so comfortable, though.
Oh, they're wonderful. They're great. They're great shoes. They're not paying us any money, but I would recommend Vans highly. They're fantastic shoes. Slip-on Vans, wonderful, wonderful shoes.
If someone from Vans is listening, pay us money. But
Exactly. I would like some shoes. Like yeah, I would get down for just some shoes.
Pay me in shoes. Yes, totally.
Love it. So this week we're going to have one of our good friends, Kyle Carpenter, on to talk about Game of Thrones. We planned this before the last episode, and then the last episode, episode 5 of season 6, was just incredible. So it couldn't have worked out better. Like maybe the best episode of that series. And so it couldn't have worked out better. So we're going to have him on. But before we do that, we wanted to hit a little bit of news. There wasn't as much news as there was last week, but there was some really, really important news that I know came out today, and that is that the Guardians of the Galaxy have been confirmed. They are going to be in the Infinity War, saga. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and that is as confirmed as you can get at this point in a Marvel production. They're as secretive as any production I've seen. So talking to Nerdist, two of the guys the two guys that wrote Civil War and are soon going to be writing Infinity War said, you know who owns the gauntlet and you know who is in another movie, which is like as confirmed as you can get with a Marvel film. But I think that's like the worst kept secret in the MCU, that you can't do this galactic film without the Guardians of the Galaxy. Like they're the ones that set up the mythology of the Infinity Stones. They set up, I don't want to say the mythology of the gauntlet, because you see the gauntlet in the background of a scene from Thor when it was just really an Easter egg, but like they're the ones that took the MCU to this cosmic level, so you can't really have it without them. I think so many of their stories are so intrinsically tied in with Thanos. You've got Drax's story so tied in with Thanos. You've got Gamora's story so tied in with Thanos. I wouldn't be surprised after Guardians 2 if you see some Peter Quill, Star-Lord, that's tied in with Thanos. So it's like the foregone conclusion that they're going to be in there. But I'm super psyched because, you know, more Guardians, the better. Like, that was one of my favorites of this last phase.
And I had to, like, my response to this was, I didn't know this was a question. I didn't know that we were, like, his daughters were literally in the Guardians movie. Thanos' daughters are literally in the Guardians movie. Drax plays a really key, as from what I understand, Drax plays a really key role in this whole saga, or has something to do with Thanos. And so I didn't know that this was really a question. I didn't know that there was even any speculation that they wouldn't be in it. So the fact that they're willing to kind of confirm it now kind of shows how much of a foregone conclusion it already was. They have to be in these movies. There's just no way around it.
Yeah, as secretive as they are with plot details and with spoilers and all of that, it's like, again, that was them. And I think sometimes they'll throw a bone to the fans about, hey, we're giving you something. Hey, we're giving you something. So I think some of that may have been them throwing a bone to the fans and just being like, all right, quit asking us. It's kind of like when Pablo Hidalgo confirmed that Supreme Leader Snoke is not Darth Plagueis about a couple weeks back. He was just like, tired of you guys asking about it. Just be done with it. Yeah. Okay, they're in the movie. Leave us alone.
Exactly. And I can't imagine what those guys' Twitter feeds are like. Ugh. It must be awful.
I would shut mine down. You know, I would totally shut mine down if I were them.
Oh, just nonsense. So that's the biggest news of the week. There were some other interesting things that came out. The Star Trek Beyond trailer came out, and it was an interesting trailer. I want to get your thoughts on it before I kind of go into what I'm thinking about this movie, because I've been in on the Star Trek reboot the entire time, but I'm wavering a little bit. So what are your thoughts on it?
See, in this trailer, I actually had the opposite reaction. I loved the soft reboot, the alternate timeline that they did to appease everyone. I would give Into Darkness like a 7 out of 10. It wasn't as good as the first one, but it was a serviceable movie. I was entertained for 2 hours. When the first trailer for Beyond came out, I was like, well, looks like they've totally crashed this ship. Like, I was not, and I wasn't even a pun. That was just not what I wanted it to be. And then when they opened up this new trailer, they gave me the things that I care about in the movie, which are characters and plot, right? They gave me characters and conflict straight off the bat. It starts with Kirk and McCoy talking about motivations and character growth. And I'm like, cool, we're going to totally have some character development, some character. I've told you guys, I'm not a Star Trek guy, but I'm a sucker for good friendships in a film. And there are two spots in this trailer. There's a scene with the big three, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And McCoy makes the line about, are you sure you want to go back out there? Which is totally a McCoy thing. It just feels like they're friends. And then later on, McCoy and Spock are going back and forth about, you know, is death to be feared, or is death, you know, what makes living worth it? And that's totally like a great character moment. And those are the things that I love these movies for. Side note, it's not coincidental that Carl Urban is responsible for both of the good lines that I pull from this trailer. If you've listened to the last week's podcast, you know my love for Carl Urban runs deep. But I was very impressed with this trailer because it totally turned me 180 from where I was feeling very ambivalent, you know, just kind of meh about the movie beforehand.
You know, what's funny about that is we saw the same things. Before I get into this, because this is how my brain works. Like, they spent, like, in the first 30 seconds, they spent a good 5 seconds on a big splash screen that said, from the director of Fast and Furious, as if that was as if that was something that was gonna sell us on the movie. Like,
yeah.
They were gonna come in, oh, that masterpiece, Fast and Furious. Well, I definitely can't miss the next thing from the Fast and Furious director.
People love those movies, though.
No, I love them too.
Love those movies.
No, I love them too. I have nothing against them. Love them too. It's just he's not Coppola. Like, what? Like, what are we doing here?
True. But
so, aside from that, I saw the same things in the trailer that you did, and it seemed like they were trying to do the things you were talking about. But I thought none of the lines landed. None of them seemed deep or insightful in any significant way. The you're underestimating humanity storyline, like, that's about as played out as you can get a storyline. It's been played out since 1996 when Independence Day did it perfectly. So I don't really know, like, I don't really know where they're going. I think that this seems really fan service-y to me. Now, that's not to say I'm not going to watch it. I'll definitely go and watch it because it's going to have good visuals. And I trust them because I did like the first two movies. And Idris Elba, I believe, plays the villain. And
he does.
100% in. Anytime Idris Elba's in anything. The new Dark Tower series is just going to be...
Yeah.
Can't wait. But I think that I'll definitely go see it. But it does feel... I don't know. It feels a little fan service-y. I'm a little muh on it, if you know what I'm saying.
See, and I thought that was the flaw with Into Darkness, was it was way too fan servicey. Like, there's no reason for the Khan reveal other than, hey fans, it's Khan. You know, we know you love him.
He was the best of the original. Nobody yelled Khan though, right?
I don't remember. It's been a minute since I've seen that.
I don't think nobody. So as long as no one yelled Khan, it's fine.
But they did the reverse of the classic Spock death with Kirk. And then, side note, Kirk is immortal now, so let's just talk about that for a second, because now he has Khan blood, and that means he's immortal. Maybe that's just me reading too much into it. But that was my big gripe with the second film, was that it felt so fan servicey. Like, again, the Khan reveal wasn't a reveal, and it shouldn't have been a reveal in that universe because Khan wasn't a thing at that point.
Yeah.
Like, why? So, well, we can talk about Star Trek movies later on, but yeah, I was less than, that was my gripe with the second film. And I think, again, part of what makes these films good in my mind is the reverence to the source material without being slavish to the source material. They're very reverent to the source materials. They respect people's emotional connections to these, but they don't necessarily feel devoted to them.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with any of that. And, you know, I think the only difference here is that the lines landed with you and they didn't land with me. So
sure.
maybe, because they were there. I'm not going to dispute that they were there. So they landed, and so maybe they will in the theater, and maybe I'll be proven wrong on this, which happens.
And I could be wrong as well.
Literally, no, that's never been true.
When in Rome.
never been true. So the last little piece of news here is there has been some positive buzz building for Suicide Squad. We talked about it last week when we talked about Harley Quinn getting her own standalone movie. You know, that shows that Warner Brothers, that shows that DC is feeling pretty good about this movie, or at least one character in this movie. They showed to a test audience, and out of that test audience, there were tons of tweets sent. They were almost 100% positive, and not just positive, oh, I liked the movie a little bit, you know, it was good. It was like, oh my God, this is the best movie I've ever seen. Now, that's obviously hyperbole and recency bias, but
yeah,
it's still one of those things where DC has had such a bad run that to even see this kind of buzz is a good thing, and it has me excited about the movie. You excited?
Yeah, I am. I think it's hard for me to give much credence to the, I hate like the people, the audiences are loving it, and then it's some tweets with poor grammar. It's like, I have a hard time giving much credence to those.
There were lots of tweets with like 18 exclamation points, which is way too many exclamation points.
Yeah, there was one that was like perfection in filmmaking. I'm like, oh, so we're watching Citizen Kane now, which we can talk about how I feel like Citizen Kane is overrated, but that was the easiest one to grasp. But no, I
we got a Coppola and a Citizen Kane now, so
we are so pretentious.
We're gonna get a Scorsese in here. We're gonna call him Sezzy, and everybody's gonna hate us.
You're gonna call him Marty?
I'm gonna call him Marty. Hey, Marty Scorsese. So Marty and I were talking.
No, so I like the thing that's the most promising is that it feel these tweets give me the indication that at least the movie was fun.
Yeah,
like fun is what has been lacking from the last two DC movie universe movies, whatever they're calling this thing, DC film universe. That's been the thing that's been missing. Like these comic book characters are not fun. These are movies about children's characters, and they're not fun. So I think that's the big thing to take away. And how do you not do fun when you've got Captain Boomerang, when you've got Killer Croc? It has to be fun. So I think that is that's my takeaway, is that at least the movie was fun. Like the fans are enjoying it. Obviously, the people that get invited to something like this are probably really big fans, so they're predisposed to liking it. But I feel like from the tone of the trailers, from the tone of these tweets, I would say at the bottom line, I get that the movie is fun.
Yeah, and I mean, that's so much. I want them to be good movies. We talked about this with Captain America. I want superhero movies to be good movies. Yeah. But if that's unattainable for whatever reason, at least be fun and at least have a lot of explosions and be a summer movie. And like you said, it looks like this is going to happen. You know, maybe this is the kick in the pants that DC needs, and maybe we're going to see some improved quality. I'm certainly looking forward to it, and I definitely can't wait.
Absolutely. I think, like you said, if we get good genre movies, that means we will get more good genre movies. If it makes money and it's good, then they'll try to make another good one, which means the odds are higher that we'll get a good one.
All right, we are joined now by our very good friend, our own maester, Mr. Kyle Carpenter, to talk about the first half season of Game of Thrones. But really, as I said earlier, this was planned to be a recap of the first half season, but the fifth episode, The Door, was so good, it was so crazy, that it's probably going to lean more towards a conversation about that episode, which was filled with so much stuff, and like I said, might have been the best episode in this series. So we'll probably lean a little bit a little bit that way. And so to bring Kyle in, I guess the first thing to do would be, what are kind of your initial thoughts after watching that episode? What were your initial thoughts the first time you saw it?
Well, the first thing is thank you for having me on here. Sorry I missed the first part, my three dogs bit of news. But, I have some nerd credentials too, all right? I'll take it Fallout 3. What an episode, man. That has to be one of the most intense hours of television I've ever seen, no matter the show. But certainly Game of Thrones, that's the most, like, packed in. There's, like, probably 18 different moments, and I furiously scrolled a notebook I look like.
He actually has it written on paper as if he lives in Game of Thrones times. That is what he's written it on.
Obviously on a scroll, and I will deliver it to you via email or Raven.
And you do you have your own sigil and your own wax that you could send it to me in? Because I would appreciate that very much.
Oh, if you want to get into the finer things, I mean, if we're going to jump right in and get into the finer points of wax and the pink letter of Ramsay's Bolton Seal versus some of the others, we can do that, but we may want to save that,
we'll save that
a little bit.
Extra DVD extras. We'll put it down.
The deep dive nerddom, yeah.
The after show.
Indeed, but no, like Beautiful Mind over here, I just have notes, scrawled all over Russell Crowe style. Obviously the place to start with that episode is just like the tear-jerking ending, right?
I guess we should say at the beginning, there are going to be spoilers here.
All up in
it's going to be nothing but spoilers.
Yeah, and for someone who read the books, like, there were a ton of spoilers. Like, this we can talk about as well, how far, like, this just fast-forwarded past the books. There was so much revealed, but...
Praise the Lord, by the way.
I still have some back-pocket elitism, things that y'all don't know if you haven't read the books, And hopefully they'll keep like a nugget or two of those so we can keep our entitled superiority. There was two deaths actually right at the end that combined to bring my tears. Of course, you have the great elevator doorsman, Hodor, holding the door. And the music and like they're looking back and it was epic.
What a setup that is. Like, that's a deep setup. I tell a joke that I love that my wife Sarah hates called the coffin joke, which takes about 5.5 minutes to get to a terrible punchline. And I love that joke because it makes people just sit in suspense until a horrible, horrible punchline hits them in the face and they just go, I hate you so much that I want you to die. This did the same thing, except the punchline was amazing and was done so well. And like you said, was tear jerking. Because I'm insane, I was more affected by Summer dying than I was by Hodor, maybe. But still, both of them were just so emotional and so tear jerking, and they did it so expertly well.
Well, I think the thing that is, you didn't just get one good performance in that, because you see a lot of these death scenes that are like one or two good performances, but everybody in these scenes, whether it was Hodor in the past or Hodor in the present, like they both crushed it. The characters made you feel the weight of it. You could see that they were just distraught. It was also one of the most legitimately terrifying scenes that they've ever done. Just the whole build up, just that whole 3.5, and it felt so much longer than I think it was timed to like 3.5 minutes. It felt like it was only
3.5 minutes.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah, like from the time they started storming the tree till Hodor bites it is like 3.5 minutes.
Wow,
that felt like an eternity. Like it was like you were gripped the entire time. And like you said, it was so emotional. I was sitting there, and whenever Summer dies, needlessly, let me say, first of all, whenever she dies, I literally screamed out an expletive, and I was so distraught that my wife felt the need to grab my shoulder and rub it and say, like, it's going to be okay. I was so distraught by this dog dying, at direwolf, sorry. And then not, I guess, a minute and a half later, we have Hodor, and it's just, like, what's crazy about this episode, and I think what we want to talk about, is that this ending was so good that it's made people forget everything else that happened. And literally, I think, like, Kyle, you have probably there on your Madman scroll something. You probably have like 30 crazy things that happened in that episode that would have been episode enders in lesser Game of Thrones episodes. And they happened
And in lesser shows, it would have been like series enders, you know, like exactly. These were like, oh, game changer, you know, like, okay, Jon Snow dying at the end of last season, again, spoilers, guys, he comes back, but that happening was like, oh my gosh, you know, huge cliffhanger, but like, yeah, there was probably like 10 of those, right? Like, I mean, like you said, in that one sequence, you have the death of Summer, you're now left with, you know, two direwolves in the entire world.
Maybe two.
Right, and I'm going to assume Nymeria's out there.
I'm thinking she still
knows she's a direwolf, right? Because that's the whole thing, is like, she's kind of rolling with... like Kevin Nash, a very weakened, like 2004, 2005, Conan is your only star, maybe Scott Hall, Wolfpack.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. What was it? NWO? NWO is forever, but Wolfpack is for life? Or did
for
I get those back?
Life.
Yeah. That is accurate. Yes.
Sir. Yeah. But yeah, so Nymeria has her wolf pack, whatever. But yeah, so I mean, like that was devastating. And then you have Leaf, like, who's just like, you know, not a substantial character that we've had emotional investment in, but like, again, the like almost Christ-like sacrifice, like take one for the team, like drops the bomb to blow up everything, including the corpse of Nymeria, because in the books, the others are claimed to have also ridden direwolves, which is frightening.
And she might have been the last of her people. Like, we're not clear on that, but it seems like she's the last of her people. Like, the children are now no more. Like, they are extinct.
That could be the case. Who knows? But I hope not. But yeah, it could be. And it's. I mean, interesting. I guess we can seg. I don't know if we're done talking about it. We could probably talk 30 minutes just about the Hodor and all the ending scene getting out of the cave. But to kind of transition there. The ending, but you also saw really the beginning of this show with their cut to Leaf creating the others or the White Walkers. It's it's incredible, right? Like, the books have no idea. There's legends and there's stories told by people, and you can try to piece it together, but they literally just said, nope, you have no idea. Benioff and Weiss are in charge now, right? And we are saying in the canon, this is how this happens, that basically the shard of dragon glass was wedged in the chest of whoever that guy was before he became
one of the first men. King.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of looks a little Jor-ish, you know, blonde hair, kind of weirdly handsome. Looked, Wolfpack shout out. Very much frightened, which I was kind of interesting. I guess I would be if someone had me tied to a tree.
You're telling me if something that looks like a head of cabbage was trying to stab you in the chest with obsidian, you would be like, all right, this seems like a normal Tuesday.
Well, whatever was in his heart before clearly became something just unbelievably cold. He got an ice box where his heart used to be. There's another good Revan story. But yeah...
Little Giants reference?
No, that was Gerald. You might have to help me out here. There was a Marcus Houston, like 2009.
Oh, yeah,
terrible R&B song.
Terrible R&B song.
Yeah, somewhere thereabouts. But also Icebox. We could take it back. I could give you a theory of how the Little Giants explains
the annexation of Puerto Rico explains the White Walkers.
Entirely. We'll get to that next week if you ever have me back. But it's funny, right? Because he was human at one point. He showed real human fear and emotion, and then all of a sudden, now he is this thing, this lifeless. And it's always interesting when like I'd love to hear Martin talk about the books when people ask him and just hear his thoughts, because like you can read it and get an idea, but when he talks about it, sometimes it distills it really kind of succinctly, and he can tell you. And he always described the White Walkers as like elegant, you know, like beautiful in a way, mysterious. Like, they're not dead. He wouldn't call them dead. They're just this other thing. So it's interesting, right? Like, whatever they became is supposedly the embodiment of pure evil in this duality of good versus evil. If that is the case, and you can get more into that. But basically these things were created out of fear, out of human emotion, into the whole nemesis of this show. And it's crazy that we saw that. Again, that could be a season ender. Like, that's a huge moment, and it took 30 seconds of screen time.
Yeah, well, and I think that's been the biggest win of this season, is that them outpacing Martin's writing has given them the freedom to tell a story at a good pace. Like, that has been, I think, the biggest complaint over the last several seasons, is it's just taken them so long to get to these plot moving moments because they feel like they need to adapt the books, and now there's not a book to adapt. And so they're able to say, okay, now we're going to tell a story like it's 2016 and people understand how stories work and how mythology works.
And I mean, it's not even that they don't have a book to adapt as much. There are still scenes from the upcoming book, the play that Arya watches, or I guess the nameless girl, I guess, watches in Braavos is straight out of the upcoming book. Like that was the scene that they were given access to. And so there are still things that we're going to be seeing coming and forth, but you're right. It allows them to tell a deeper story. And, you know, we're talking about the kind of breadth of this episode, and we haven't even gotten to an emotional goodbye between Dany and Jorah, which that's a big deal. We haven't gotten to a Red Priestess who looks like she's going to be a really important and key figure moving forward in this series. We didn't even get to Sansa having a conversation, maybe the most important conversation of her character's arc so far, with Littlefinger in a barn that looks like the burned out remains of a Dragon Age Inquisition set. I didn't really know where they were, but that's kind of what it looks like to me. But she's having this conversation that is probably the turning point, the most important point in this character's development, and it was in the first, 10 minutes of the episode, and then people are forgetting about it. So when we're talking about the breadth of this episode, we're talking about so many things that happen, and that's what made it so great, is that it just moved through. But I guess moving past this episode, and I, you know, we'll all pour some out for Hodor, but moving past this episode, I guess maybe what are some of the themes, and this episode certainly brought a lot of them to the forefront, but what are some of the things, I guess we'll start with you, Kyle, what are some of the themes that you're really seeing coming out of this season?
I think maybe you're seeing, like we've talked about, the acceleration of the world, right? Like chess pieces are finally moving in the sense that, so like this is the White Walker's great, like, first strike. This is the entrance. This is, you know, this is something. Something has happened. What happens next, we're not sure, but this could be the start of something happening. So what that means to me is there's going to be a counter, right? There has to be, because there's this duality of fire and ice, of light and darkness and all these things always in the show. So if the White Walkers are starting, we already have dragons in their infancy, but they have to get over there. Something has to happen. And so something we haven't even talked about was the whole Iron Islands,
yeah, exactly, King's
Moot. That's going to be huge. And in the books, that was, you know, whole books, that was huge. So yeah, that's going to be interesting. Is that the vessel? Are these the, you know, the cargo ships that basically bring her into this world? Is that what that was? That they put this entirely ambitious, you know, person in Euron on the throne at Pike. You know, he is the king of the Iron Islands. Is that now going to accelerate that?
Or is that what Yara and Theon are going to do? Are they trying to get there first? Because it's not like they, you know, they're taking all these ships. It's not like they have, I mean, they're raiders. It's not like any place they land on the coast, they're going to be welcome with open arms in Westeros. So are they maybe trying to beat him to the punch and get there first? Like, where are they going? What are they doing? Which, like you said, I went through all those other storylines because we didn't get to some of them. And then there you go. The King's Mood is there. And that's crazy what's happened there. So it's insane. What about you, G? What are some things you're seeing?
I think the theme that I hope to see more of is really goes back to the creation of the White Walkers, that what we create to combat what we fear ends up coming back to bite us. Like we create these White Walkers to fight the new man, and then they end up and literally when Leaf dies, like that, they end their line. The thing that they created to protect them now has caused them harm. And so we saw that theme creep up with a lot of things that happened. you know, with the Night's Watch. And so I think we continue to see that. And hopefully that ends up being how Ramsay finds his end maybe later, but we'll talk about that toward the end.
But even in King's Landing, we're seeing it right now in King's Landing with Cersei. Like that, exactly what you're describing is exactly what happened. She wanted so bad to get back at Margaery that she created her own demise and she created her own downfall. And it's been a theme. It's been a theme that's gone on since season one that we've seen these people that they consistently create the situations that lead to their downfall, whether it's through, you know, too much booze or whether it's through just being way too noble and not knowing when to quit. We just see it over and over again that these people are so self-destructive. And the play did a really good job with this, where we see these characters and we see Sansa and we see all of these characters and we remember Ned and we remember Robert and we think of them because they're the central characters of the show. We think of them as the most important things in the world. But when you watch that play, it shows you how the common folk think about these people, because these people are just buffoons. They're nothing. They're just idiots that can't get out of their way. They're the Greek gods, essentially, who are just there to almost be mocked in some way, because these people just, they're so sitting up in their castle, scheming and brooding and worrying about all of these unimportant things while the people below them are just getting on with their lives. And that play, I think, was such an interesting kind of glimpse into the world of Game of Thrones that we never actually get to see.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. So the biggest thing
crushed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a couple other things, but I mean, that was so elegantly and
we'll throw them out there. Come on.
I think we're also seeing, and we've seen this, I mean, since the beginning of the show, people have even, I think, explicitly said it at times, but it's really ramping up now is the supernatural, the magic, these things that don't exist in our world as we understand them, but that's part of what draws us to this. Hold on. The fantasy is the...
You don't know that.
You are right. Yeah, you're right. I'm the maester. I'm a doubter. You know, I study the text, the tomes, and I doubt the things I can't explain with my big, heavy chain with all the links in it.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, so, I mean, it's incredible to look. It's like it's getting stronger, right? There's something that says, like Melisandre says, she feels stronger at the wall than she did even in the mythical Shadow City where she came from. And you know, you think back to things like, I mean, I think it was season two or three where Dany was with the House of the Undying, and she sees these visions and sees things, and it's like starting to happen. But they said, you know, glass candles have burned for the first time in 100 years, right? Like something is happening. Magic is coming back into the world stronger. So the interesting thing to me is the wall, right? So that was built with tons of ice and manpower and probably giants and things, but it was also built with some supernatural element that effectively keeps people out. Well, this Weirwood cave was also that way, right? And something broke that. So what happens with the wall? Is it also broken? Is it, you know, it'll be interesting to me because that's the next big obstacle, and maybe they spend 8 episodes just like standing on one side of it shouting. I don't know, but I imagine it'll probably go quickly if this season is anything to go by, that we may be moving, you know, pretty quickly. There's still 2 more seasons, I believe, of the show, so that, you know, they have to save something. But yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's going to start picking up. And like I said, the supernatural with Bran, there's an interesting thought whether Bran is, you know, some people, I don't want to get too much into the theories and the tinfoil out there, but some people say he'll warg a dragon and he'll fight the others. And there's some people that say he's going to help the others. Like, that kind of stuck with me. Like, no, he's a Stark. He's of noble, you know, they're the good guys. This has been established. But it's like, you know, the three-eyed raven, like, you know, he says stuff to him in the show. Just like, you know, the darkness is your mother's milk. You will learn from it. You will grow from it. You'll become powerful from it. It's almost like, well, did the others get him? Did they get him first? You know, it's almost like he's this weapon, right? So it's very interesting to see how this great supernatural uprising, like who will fall where and when it will all come together and how it will affect the people people without that, who are just living the world and caught up in vanity and infighting and silly things, and eventually become aware of this and do they bond and is it enough and all those things. So it's going to be the human element told through a supernatural element. I think it's going to be really good. I'm desperately looking forward to.
And I think it speaks to the abilities of both Martin and the showrunners as storytellers, that, and to bring back a point you made at the beginning, Kyle, where they started off and it wasn't a show about magic. It was swords and sorcery without the sorcery. It was just the swords. And they've slowly built to that, to a point where we've got a teenager that can jump from the past to the present, from mind to mind, doing all sorts of crazy things. We've got, you know, tree people, and it's slowly building to something. And I think what we see in the finale, where, you know, we're 20 episodes away, the last two seasons, I think half seasons are like 6 and 7 episodes. But I think what we're going to see is going to be something completely unexpected, because that has always been the tone of it. Okay, you were expecting this, and we give you the White Walkers. You know, you're expecting, even season 1, you're expecting Ned Stark to be the hero of the story. Two-thirds of the way through the season, dude's dead. So I think that's the trouble with trying to predict this narrative, is that at every turn, it turns your expectations on their ear. And I love it. It's one of the first times seeing a narrative, following a narrative, that I have not been able to at least accurately predict it to about 80%, which is fantastic.
One thing I do want to go, and if we can all roundtable real quick and just say, is now that we've introduced, you know, a Time Traveler's Guide to Westeros or whatever, and we saw Bran pull off an Inception-like move where he wards Hodor and then post-verse, pre-verse wards Hodor also. And you could get lost.
He was in like
that.
level 3. He was affecting level 1. It was deeply confusing.
Yeah,
I'm surprised you didn't draw that diagram out, Kyle.
Well, it's on page 2. Okay. But no, the question is, what is Bran's totem? This is Inception. How does he know which world is real? It's not Hodor.
I think
not Summer.
I think the ability to feel his foot. It's probably the most important.
If I can stand, then I'm dreaming.
Functioning legs is his totem. Okay, that's fair enough.
I feel real bad for saying that now. Take some time and regroup.
We are not ableist on this podcast. You know, there's no bias.
The most powerful person on the show, arguably, is the one with a physical, you know, physical ailment. So I think it's
Jorah.
You know what that does? Yeah, I know what that does. It was such a lethal weapon. Like, that was such a weird, like, they're trying to do like a buddy cop drama in the middle of Dos, or whatever they call it. Dos Vothrak, is that what it's called?
I think it's Vise Dothrak. Right,
yeah. One of those things. But yeah, they're sitting there in the middle of it having a buddy comedy, and I loved it. So I guess the biggest theme I've taken out of this entire season, and Kyle, you and I talked about it, episode 1. I think while episode 1 was happening, we were talking about this, is that they made it very clear from the beginning that they were going to change the role of women in this show. And they've done it in a very dramatic way. We saw it in the first episode in Dorne, where the Sand Snakes just take over. By the way, we haven't seen them since. Literally the only thing that we've seen them do was kill their king and take over. And then I guess kill the prince on the boat. That's it. And so from that point, they kind of set up that this was going to be a season of the ladies. And so far, it's kind of played out that way. And obviously, there are the big kind of story arcs with Dany and what Dany's been able to do with Dothraki and with Sansa and what she's been able to do. And obviously, that scene she had with Littlefinger is her becoming the leader of the Starks, essentially, is what that scene, what that meant to me. Now, obviously, she still needs Jon, and we'll see where that goes, but that's what I saw from that scene. But even if you watch this show more critically, and if you watch it at its, you know, in the little ways that they film scenes, and the little scenes that they put in the show, you can tell that they're making a concerted effort to have stronger women. And one of the scenes that really stuck out to me was a couple weeks ago, we're in the small council room, whenever they're trying to decide what they're going to do, and we have Cersei and Olenna in that room, and Kevin Lannister and Jaime Lannister are there, and they're playing a role in this conversation. But if you go back and you watch that scene, the focus of the camera is always on Cersei and Olenna, because they are the ones that are pulling these strings. They are the ones that are actually making these decisions. And that's such an important idea, is that the king is not doing anything. He's a boy who doesn't know what he's doing. You know, Jaime and Kevin feel like they're in control, but they're not in control at all. Cersei controls Jamie, and Olenna controls Kevin essentially at this point. And so we see who's actually in power, and it's those two. And you see it even in last week's episode, this Red Priestess comes in, and she has two of the most, you know, two of the most quick-witted, two of the most sure people in themselves in the world sitting in this room with her and Varys and Tyrion, and she walks in and undresses both of them. Varys has never looked that concerned in his entire life, and she just essentially undressed him. And we see that she is, you know, obviously it's a great introduction to this character, but again, we see another woman taking hold. And so, Kyle, when we were talking about this, you brought up a great point that this is clearly the theme of this season. This is clearly what the overarching theme of this season is, that the women are kind of taking over and taking control. Was this always the plan, or is this a kind of a response to what happened last season, especially the outrage over Sansa?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because there have been some super gruesome, super grotesque things throughout the history of the show, and we laughed them off and things. But it was like last season it came to a tipping point with Shireen and with the wedding night of Sansa, and she even had a kind of unsettling line where she said something about like, I can still feel what Ramsay did inside of me. And I was just like, oh my gosh.
And
like,
I meant to make that point, by the way, is that that's one of the things that's so strong in that scene, is she didn't let it just go. She didn't let him just sit there and think. She made him know. She did not let it go. This is what happened to me. And if you're going to leave here alive, you're going to know what you led me to. You're not going to be able to think about the best things that could possibly happen. You're going to know that the worst things did happen to me. And that was such a powerful moment for her.
And not just that they happened, but that they're directly his fault. And she blames him for that. And that is going to be the reason why that she is going to have no part of what he wants to accomplish. Like, your inability to treat me as an equal and as a person has now cost you your ability to be a part of what we are trying to accomplish.
And you basically have to ask, right? Was this the genius of the showrunners all along? They did these gruesome things to make you feel something so strongly, and this reaction. And this was, guys, this was always what we're doing. Or was it, you know, really just like, oh my gosh, like, we got to get back on track. Like, you know, strong female characters has been a theme since the beginning, but really has been ramped up in this season. We didn't even talk about the Hillary Clinton, you know, Kingsmoot, where she got mansplained to by Euron Grey Trump, but make Iron Islands great again. But
that is the best metaphor you have ever made in your entire life. That is wonderful.
But yeah, right? So, I mean, you have, like, the super strong woman who her brother's not coming back and taking it. Her uncle, you know, had to give the speech. And in the books, the speech was much better. This was just, like, a bunch of juvenile genital jokes and shouting. But still a rousing speech and got himself elected king or whatever. But then, even then, she didn't let him seize her, you know, her autonomy, her ability to act. And so she goes and takes the ships and goes to do who knows what. But acts, you know, and then Brienne is this, I mean, she's one of the few people in this world who has this Valyrian steel, which could be helpful in a war against people who can only die from a few things, including that, but is this strong presence who protects, you know, Sansa. She doesn't need a man to protect her. She has this great warrior who happens to be a woman who, you know, has been feared and won these battles, and there's just these strong women, but there is that sense of, like, would they have this planned all along? Is this what they always wanted to do? We can't really know what they would have done with Shireen, right? I mean, again, neither of these things really particularly happens in the books. So that was kind of their call to do it, especially with burning of the daughter. But yeah, it's like, I hope that this was their plan all along. I really, truly do. Because I want to think these guys are great guys and smart guys and have a firm grasp and know exactly what they're doing. And this was a setup. It's terrible. It's bad. Ned Stark died, but we got better. These, you know, terrible things happen to the women, but it gets better. Season, you know, this season is all about, you know, it's like a Beyonce album dropping in the middle of, you know, of Westeros. And it's fantastic. You know, who run the world, girls. So I hope that was always their plan.
Do you think it was, Gerald?
I, like Kyle said, I hope so. It feels like there are shades of it early on, even from, you know, the very first season or the earliest parts of the narrative, where, you know, Dany is literally the reason through which dragons and magic, really. That's the first instance of true magic coming back into the world. Like, one of the most powerful people in this narrative is this woman who was once looked down upon by her brother as just a means to an end. And so I think it's maybe not a story of women being powerful, but women reclaiming their power. I think it's probably a good way to, at least how I would interpret it, because Dany has reclaimed her power. Sansa has reclaimed her power. All these women are reclaiming their power. So I think that is that's a great way to view it, and at least a great way to frame it in my mind. It reminds me of when you ask Joss Whedon, somebody asked Joss Whedon in an interview once, you know, why do you always write women, such powerful women, in your stories? And he said, because you still have to ask that question. So I think this reminds me of that, where it's we are showing that women in narratives, really, not to make this big meta statement, but women in narratives can have agency of their own and reclaim it without it needing to be a subject. They're just powerful. It doesn't matter that they're a woman in power. They're just in power, and they happen to be women.
Yeah, I agree with that. But we didn't. But then again, we didn't see it for so long that something makes me think that even if this was some way planned, that this is still a response in some ways to what they were dealing with. And if so, good, because it's changed the show for the better. I'm really, one of the things, and we'll get into this now, we'll segue into this. One of the things I'm really looking forward to as we move forward towards the end of this saga is the development of Sansa. And I think that, you know, there are things about her, even from last episode, that she has this understandably warped, but still warped view of who the Starks are and how other people view them. And that, you know, again, that gets back into what we're talking about with the play. Like, these people think that they're beloved. The Starks truly believe they're beloved, and maybe they are. But it's funny to me. It was funny to me that she came in and said, they'll follow us. Well, why would they follow you? Because we're the Starks. Obviously they'll follow us. And it's such a kind of privileged kind of idea. And maybe she's right. Maybe these people will follow them because they're the Starks. But she still has that kind of mentality, and there's still that little kid mentality. Well, why wouldn't they follow us? We're the Starks. But on the other hand, we see that she's growing as a character, and she's really becoming strong. And I want to see her make that full transition, because I think that could be a really interesting storyline. It's something I'm looking forward to a lot. What about you guys? Gerald, what else are you looking forward to?
Well, and just to hopefully put this out there in the world, that anytime that someone, anytime one of the Starks makes one of these types of decisions, it ends up biting them in the rear. And so I'm terrified that, you know, you just think of, like, you know, Ned's decisions to, you know, oh, of course I can write this wrong. I'm Ned Stark. Rob's decision of course I can be the king. I'm Rob Stark. You know, John, of course I can lead this army. I'm maybe a Stark. We can argue about his parentage later. But all and now Bran's is, of course I can go and do this thing that I was told not to do. All of these decisions turn out so poorly, and I feel like they're punished for that thinking. So that honestly terrifies me a bit, because if more bad things happen to the Starks, I don't know if I can handle it. But I think the thing really that I'm looking forward to is I just want to see how it wraps up. Like, I'm so, like I said earlier, I have no clue where this thing is going. Any time that I try to predict where it's going, it completely turns it on its ear. And so that is so exciting for me, as we talk a lot of times, Raymond. I'm the comic reader, so I go into these, you know, these comic book movies with so much knowledge about what's going to happen, that the fact that I'm just simply sitting here guessing is an amazing feeling, because I just have nothing. I am shocked, and I'm every week I'm shocked, and it's jaw dropping, and so I'm excited, because expectations have always been not even exceeded, because there are no expectations. So I think they find a way to set and blow expectations all within the span of 5 minutes, and I'm so excited about that.
And Kyle, I know this is one that I'm actually interested in, but I know that you love these people, and so I'm going to let you wax poetic for a while. And that is about the Reeds. Mira, Howland, it looks like we're going to get to meet finally, even though we saw him in the flashback to the Tower of Joy. So I'm interested in what's going to be these people's role. What are they going to be doing as we move forward? Because it looks like they're going to be playing a role as we move forward.
Yeah, so they're super interesting because in the books they always play an important part, but we don't know a ton about them. Like, they're just this great mysterious figure that's right under our noses. They're historically these fantastic allies to the Starks. They're bannermen, but one thing that I hate to get into this type of stuff, but was when we finally saw Howland Reed, I also didn't love Ned Stark being like a capricious, you know, like fast talker as a 21-year-old or whatever.
That was not Ned Stark. Unless they're saying
I think he had a Cockney accent. I don't know. But whatever it was, I didn't like that casting. But what you were saying?
Unless they're going to make the point, and we're not going to get into it, but unless they're going to make the point that the expected events of the Tower of Joy are going to change him and make him into Noble Ned, but he was already Noble Ned before. So like that whole description of him.
Yeah, Noble. He was like a 3-year-old Noble. You know, he was always a good dude.
That's why nobody buys the illegitimate child thing, because he was Noble Ned. So.
Exactly. Yeah, and he was meek, and there's tons of theories. Like, he wouldn't even talk to women. He was so shy. His brother Brandon had to introduce him to the Sword of the Morning's sister, actually, Shara Dane, who he danced with at the tourney at Harrenhal, and was this great world beauty. But
you should have just seen Gerald's eyes. I wish everybody on the podcast could have just seen the look that Gerald gave. Like, oh Lord, he's getting into this.
Yeah.
Oh, sometimes you just have to let it. I mean, I'm trying to keep it about 90. I don't want to keep it 100, if you will, on the nerd scale. Because people will just turn off. It's like, this is worse than George R. R. Martin. This is like super nerd who doesn't have a neck beard like George is talking about this stuff. Shout out to your neck beard, Raymond. But did you get back to the Reeds? Like, they cast Howland Reed. The Krannic men are these small men. Like, you know, they're like the 5-footers. They're always short. You know, that's what makes them so deadly, is maybe they're underestimated. But he's like as tall as Ned or taller. He's like a power forward on that roster. So I didn't love that, but I hope that they do a better job, because he's so interesting. The whole family, they live in a castle that floats and cannot be found. They can't be attacked because it just floats along a marsh, which is so cool. They hide like in the bogs on the road and like just take people out unassuming. They're these built-in booby traps in somewhat human form. The Krannic men are awesome, but Howland Reed is this lifelong friend of Ned's. He's the only remaining person who can actually solve the link of what happened at the Tower of Joy. He's the only one alive from there at this point, who saw everything, knows everything, and is this sworn and trusted ally and advisor and friend to Ned, who would have a vested interest in the truth, you know, ultimately prevailing. But then you had his kids, the Wonder Twins. You had Jojen, who, again, everyone seems to be sacrificing everything for Bran. So, like, he can't mess this up. Like, there's, like, 10 deaths, you know, in route to him getting to the Weirwood Tree and now getting out of it and wherever they go next. We could talk about, if we have the time, about how he gets there, right? It may be someone meets him, you know, who has poor circulation and his hands are a bit icy. But whoever it is that ultimately, they, I don't think Mira can pull that along. But anyways, these people are dying to get him there. But yeah, so Jojen Reed is a great Reed. And then Mira Reed, who's the other one with him. So they've been these super integral characters, but kind of written like their physical stature, just kind of off to the side, a little bit smaller than the big characters, somewhat unassuming, but deadly and critically important. So I love me some Reeds. This is the most we're hopefully getting to see. We haven't heard in the books from where Howland is and what's been going on. Like, you know, it's a lot of this just like fan theory of what's going on, what it is, what it means, who it is. So the show has to go there, right? At some point, Mira goes home or something happens. There has to be this connection where we figure out a little bit more. So I am stoked to see what happens with the family Reed.
And I want to play off something you said about, you know, people keep giving up their lives for Bran. And that was one of the things, and this would be something, again, I'm looking forward to. That was one of the things about Hodor's death. I was super sad. It was very heartbreaking. But it was also hopeful in a way, because the fact that Hodor was fated to die at that door from, you know, way back when, means that they are on the right path, or at least they're on the fated path that they've been on before. So if we think that all of these people are going, if we think that the good side, and Kyle, I know you have some interesting theories on the good side, but if we But if we get into
a whole nother podcast,
yeah, it's a whole nother podcast. We may get that one in June. But the if we think the good side's going to win, that means that Bran is on the correct path for the good side to win. Does that make any sense? Like, if this has been fated to happen, then he's going down that right path. And so in some ways, that's hopeful that this is all going to, for lack of a better word, plan.
I don't know necessarily if... See, for me, I tread lightly with hope and in this narrative. I think every time we see, we think we have a prophecy, it turns out that it just doesn't matter. You know, so I think, I think that I hope that they're on the right path. I think they've done, like Kyle said, they've done too much to keep Bran alive. Even like narratively, I think they've done so much to invest in this character that unless this character turns out to be a major player in whatever happens, whether it's on the good side or the good side, depending on how your interpretation goes, I think that they're, for lack of a better term, wasting screen time if this character does not end up being something great. I think that is even with Ned Stark, who really set almost all of the war in motion. You know, he was a pivotal character, even though he didn't have a ton of screen time. So I think they have to be building towards something, or else they've wasted, I think, so many narrative opportunities there.
And we found out earlier in the season with Jon and his ultimate resurrection. And we go back to whatever that was with the banners, without borders. What were they?
Brothers without banners.
Doctors without borders.
Doctors without borders. Yeah. I couldn't remember what it was, but
Brotherhood without banners.
There you go. Brotherhood without banners. When we go back to those guys, you know, those guys randomly in season three get a couple episode run and we see the Hound goes there and, you know, kills a guy and they brings it back to life. And we think, well, that was really a throwaway nothing. And then we come back to the beginning of this season and, oh, they were setting something up. So I think what we've seen in the show is that they don't waste a lot of screen time, and they certainly don't waste as much screen time as they give into Bran. And so he is on a path that will be important. And I feel very comfortable saying that. And so we'll see where he goes, and we don't know that. And like you said, we don't know where Mira's taking him, and we don't know who they're going to meet. And that could be a really interesting kind of reveal as we move forward. But this, I think, I feel very comfortable in saying we're on this path. I have a question just to throw out there, roundtable style. Why do they keep killing the wolves? What are they doing? Like, at this point, it seems to mean something. Like, we've gotten so far, and they killed so many wolves. And they killed two in the last 3 weeks. So this is something. It seems to me that something's meaningful. So why do you think they're killing the wolves? Is it meaningful? And what do you think's happening? Kyle, go ahead.
So yeah. So the there's an attachment to like nature and the animals, and the Starks, I think, are literally, the metaphor is a wolf, right? And they talk about, in the books, when they reference sometimes, you know, they'll talk about Ned as a kid and they called him the lonely wolf. You know, like it's a very much, there's an English term for this, and I'm sorry, Mr. Pusateri, it's eluding me. But anyways, yeah, they literally use the wolf as a stand-in for the Starks. And so maybe in that way, we've seen the King of the North, the great wolf, the strongest, the most ferocious warrior, Robb's dire wolf, has died. We saw, you know, Sansa's very early on, and kind of her innocence with it, which has ever since been dying, died, right? So there was the, you know, the warrior in the lost war. There was the innocence of Sansa that was gone. There's the separation of Arya from Nymeria, the same way there's a separation from Arya and her Stark name. She is, you know, I like how you said it, Arya, comma, no one, or no one, comma, Arya, last first. But yes, I mean, there's that separation. Rickon, who in the books is the youngest, of course, and in the show, but is kind of described as woolly and wild and crazy, and Shaggy Dog is similar, is just this kind of a little bit unpredictable, you know, can have great strength, but oscillates wildly. His was an off-screen death, you know, and was presented to Ramsay. I know people want to hope that somehow that was a fate, but I don't think so. I think that's more of a speaking to the brutality and the grotesque, and then the severance by one of their sworn vassal houses, literally cutting the head and cutting ties with the Stark. So I think there is. I think on all of those there is some allegory and some some connection directly to it. It's interesting that right now, the one who, you know, is most tangentially a Stark, Jon Snow, is the one with Ghost who has his direwolf by his side now that Summer has tragically died. I don't know exactly yet. I haven't processed what Summer's death means to Bran. But like I said, the fact that Jon ultimately has it and really is the last maybe vestige to the Starks, even though he's not by name, you know. And so I don't know. I think there is something there. I don't know if I have it pinned down or maybe all thoughts on it that we'll get it. But I think we'll see something. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope it's something. Again, I hope that narrative thread does lead somewhere. But you see, and Kyle, I haven't read all the books, but I read part of the first book, and then I was like,
that's all you need.
I read slowly, and 700 pages would literally take me the rest of my life. But you know, when the direwolves are found, John's direwolf is not with the rest of the direwolves. So I think there's also some symbolism there when it comes from John's story and John's narrative. I think is going to end up somewhere separate from the rest of his Stark family. Whether it's I don't know where it ends up. Again, I've commented on that several times. But I think there's got to be some symbolism there, and I think, you know, going back to the direwolves and death of something significant, you know, you see obviously we have the direwolf that dies this week, and Hodor, who has been one of the only constant in Bran's lives since he was crippled, passing. So I think it's always a symbol of a loss of something great for them, a loss of something formative for them, a loss of something central to them seems to be tied with these direwolves.
And maybe that's also, like I said, Bran's severance from the North, from one side of the wall versus the other, right? Maybe
it's his end of being a Stark. He's now the three-eyed Raven. Like maybe that's what would, like maybe that's what we're looking at, is that he's the new, you know, his mentor is gone. Now he is the mentor. He's not a Stark anymore, and that's why the wolf is gone. Arya is not a Stark anymore. Her wolf is gone. You know, it's an interesting. Well, and even with Sansa, when her wolf is killed, at that point she was betrothed to Joffrey. She was a Stark still, but it was anticipated that was no longer going to be the case. I think there's something here.
Yeah, she wasn't betrothed yet. They were visiting the in Winterfell, and basically it was Nymeria who bit, because Arya beat Joffrey in a duel.
I thought it was on the road to King's Landing after they were already on the way.
I'll have to think on that, but I know for sure it wasn't Lady's fault, right? Lady was, dour, sure. You know, was dapper, sure. and well behaved, just as Sansa was at that point. And so basically it was like Sansa, it was something out of her control happening to her direwolf, right? I think is the thing there. She's this just terrible series of trauma. I mean, she literally just had trauma. I mean, I know no marriage is perfect, and you know, they'd be trifling sometimes, but yeah, I mean, she had to go through some of the worst. Like, the best marriage she's had to this point was to an imp, and he's the best character in the world. But nonetheless, that's not exactly batting 1,000. But anyways, yes, yeah, so just a sign of grotesque things done to her, right? An innocence, a youthfulness, a hopefulness, just slit, you know, the throat slit. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It's always something very significant and important.
So on that kind of same idea, I think one of the things I'm most looking forward to, and I think you guys agree, is the end of Ramsay. And I think I kind of see, giving me the preach hands. I think we're going to see it this season. You guys might disagree with that, and you can talk about it, but I think we're going to see it this season. And I think it's going to be at the hands of Sansa. And that would, by the way, the whole women power thing we talked about before, that would kind of bring it full circle. And I'm really looking forward to that. Am I way off base, Gerald?
That outside of being surprised, that's probably the one thing I'm excited about. And the thing that makes me truly hopeful is that the truly villainous characters in this show, I mean, really, we've had 2.5-ish villainous characters, and they've all met a very grotesque end. So it makes me hopeful that Ramsay is going to go out Kyle just made a shocked face.
A 2.5. I'm taking the over. there have been some super terrible dudes, but the good thing is like Arya got like 4 of them before she became known. But
true.
But no, like they've been like there've been some just terrible dudes. But yeah, a lot of them get got.
I guess my direct parallel is Joffrey's grotesque end and hopefully Ramsay's grotesque end. I think if you mistreat Sansa, you get poisoned. Hopefully, maybe that would be the way to go.
I hope the whole thing finishes and he's still alive somewhere and like the show ends and then they pop back and they're like, just kidding, all 3 dragons, and just roast him. Like, let's end the series on just a Comedy Central roast of Ramsay Snow Bolton, illegitimate child of Michael Bolton, and let's just end that. Like, let's just have him
reach for that
with,
one, Kyle.
With dragons. Yeah. And then we will all clap and be happy with a song of ice and fire. Yeah.
No, I would love like a Wayne's World ending where like, you didn't think we can end it that way. And then they give you the real ending and it's just everyone stabbing Ramsay for 5 minutes. Literally everyone.
Or the watch. Yeah.
No, and not since Joffrey died. Like that, his purple face is probably, no character's death has been rejoiced more than his death. I think Ramsay might outdo him. Like there would just be clapping in the streets. It would be like the ending scene of Remember the Titans. Everybody would just come out into the street, clap and just wave their church hands in the air. Just be so excited.
Cat Stevens song in the background. Oh, absolutely. As people just slow clap. Oh my goodness, I see it now.
Oh, it'd be wonderful. It'd just be.
Oh, nice. That's the beautiful side. Can we do a quick? I like to do quick. You know, we've talked about a lot of things we'd like to see. We think will happen since we talked about Cat Stevens ending it. I have a couple things that we won't see, but we should see that I'd just like to throw out there.
Oh, I'm very worried about this list.
Yes.
Yeah. So one is the spinoff, right? We're in an age of marketing, you know, of you have a product, you've invested in a product, spin it into its own show. So I think what we're really gonna like is when Jorah the Explorer goes to some faraway land and finds the cure to Grayscale, what that does is that actually gives him his purpose. He all along thought his purpose was serving women. He's quick to fall in love, you know, but what he found is he loves medicine even more. So Dr. Jorah, medicine man.
I knew for a fact that that's where you were going.
The spinoff is going to be HBO's next blockbuster. And maybe HBO puts it to one of their other networks they own that, you know, they don't because to test it. But it's going to be a blockbuster.
It feels like a Cinemax show, if we're going to be honest. Like, they can put it over there with that weird pirate show.
You make jokes about spinoffs, but this isn't the news section. But Jon Snow spinoff not happening, praise the Lord. Let's just go ahead and get that out there.
Hold on, there were rumors of a Jon Snow.
Oh yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah.
So George himself is writing spinoffs, right? So I think there is probably going to be a spinoff with Duncan and Aemon, Duncan Egg.
Why doesn't he write the actual books instead? Wouldn't that be?
I mean, better
source of his time.
Well, you think about it, right? Like, if you had to manually type 11,000 pages on a typewriter, as he does, and then send it by Raven to an editor and a publisher and all those things, like, you know, sometimes it's better just to distract your mind every once in a while. He might even write these other ones on computers. I don't know, but yeah, I don't know why he does that. But George, you know, it was 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, and now it's about to, or 6 years. Now it's about to be. Like 6.5 years since the last book. So he's definitely, you know, you're the math guy, Raymond. There's something for that apex that there's some kind of y over n plus x slope something.
I just wanted to be clear. I'm the math guy because I randomly took like 3 credits more than all of us fine arts majors have to take.
All of us communications majors. No, right. But. And this is not meant to be like the angry internet nerd, but if I was a 67-year-old morbidly obese man whose life work was these 1,000-page books, I would spend all of my waking hours typing. Like, that is not a value judgment on how anybody spends their life. But if my life's work was basically 1,800 pages worth of text that I needed to type, I'd probably spend some time clicking. That's all I'm saying.
We'll see when it comes. But so that's one just blockbuster idea. Sadly, I don't know if it's going to happen. But feel free to send that up the chain if y'all know anyone. My other one is I would like to see the Iron Islands. You know, we've seen this kind of culture there, and of course we've seen the priest with the long hair in the water. You know, the lifeguards, and they kill people and bring them. You know, the drowned god brings them back or whatever. You know, it's interesting. But what I liked,
they weren't really interested in helping that guy. Like, they all just kind of stood around. I'm surprised they didn't poke him with a stick. Like, I assume
that's that's for little B, the drowned god, to be in charge of, is to that was a California hip hop reference as well. But the base god has to bring him back. It can't be by people. So we saw that happen. But what I kind of would like to see is when they actually took Balon, you know, the departed king, and they wrapped him in a nice little kind of grape leaf. And it made me think, and Raymond, I know you're the sophisticated vacations. You go to Mexico. Have you ever had at one of your resorts the cochinita pibil? They wrap nicely the pork in a grape leaf and steam it, and just cooking that grape leaf, it's so delicious. So I would like to see like a Top Chef Iron Island where they use those leaves and really do something a little adventurous, you know, just the right seasoning, a little bit of smoke, a little bit of salt. That's a Prince That Was Promised reference. You know, just give me something delicious to snack on.
How did you not go for Iron Cutthroat Chef?
Yeah, that's
how
real
did you
good.
Not go there?
That's real good.
Can we rewind this back?
If we could run that, we could run that back.
I like Anthony Bourdain. Like I think that's a Conan remote waiting to happen. Anthony Bourdain visits the Iron Islands. That'd be like, you could send that up the ladder for sure.
See, these are all money making ideas, and I'm just handing them out for free. Contact my agent for more booking requests. But so that's, again, we're two for two. We've seen that. So my third one, and I think this is very apropos. And we said is the King's Moot was, you know, representative of our current election. What I want to see is the High Sparrow Bernie Sanders spinoff, where, I mean, and he may have already done it because we haven't seen them in the show, where he tackles the Bank of Bravos. Because this great power that funded Stannis, all of a sudden the High Sparrow comes to power. Where have they been? Right? I want to see Bernie Sanders going through the free cities and, you know, catapulting the banks to the nethers. I think they can keep the casting. He looks exactly the same. You know, I'm feeling the burn with the High Sparrow there. So I think that one maybe, you know, is a little bit more CNBC, but I think it would get viewers.
A little more CNBC.
Just a wee bit.
I don't know where to go from that. I don't know where to go from that.
I wish I have ever been to a play. I haven't seen Hamilton. That was as good as the Mummers in that episode. Like, that was a great play.
It was wonderful. It
the
was
rhyming,
better than the show.
Songs, it was fantastic. Like, I mean, I know that's a chapter from the book, and I haven't actually read it because I'm just going to read the book when it comes out. But I've skimmed. But if he wrote that like crisply and precisely with the rhymes and the songs, it was beautiful. I mean, that was great.
He's basically Dante at this point. Basically. So let's move on to the end segment. We do it every week. We call it Don't Sleep On It. Just talk about some things from pop culture to have our eye right now. So why don't you get started, Gerald? What do you got?
Well, Raymond, all of our talk about Star Trek last week really got me itching to watch a procedural, because that's where we landed, is that Star Trek is essentially a procedural, and that's why it's fitting that the new Star Trek show is hitting CBS's streaming service. So I started rewatching the show Psych. It was like a TNT original, and it's like my old lady show, but I love it because it's a procedural that knows it's a procedural, and so it just does fun things with it. And so it knows that, hey, this is like, they literally say at times, here's our crime of the week, and then they solve the crime of the week. it's wittier than you expect a show that was written on TNT to be. And then there are episodes where they go really serious and it catches you off guard. And again, I said it early in the news segment, one of my favorite things is relationships that feel natural in TV shows. And the two leads in this show, James Rodin and Dulé Hill, just totally hit it out of the park. with their on-screen friendship. And so I would totally recommend it. It's like 7 or 8 seasons, but again, it's a procedural, so you can be like washing dishes and not totally paying attention to it, but still pick up the big notes. That's actually what I did this weekend, is did some writing and washed some dishes while watching Psych. So that is what I'm hoping you do not sleep on for this week.
What do you got, Kyle?
I love Dulé Hill, by the way. That West Wing, good.
Fantastic.
Charlie, yeah. So there is a film coming out November, and it's long name, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And it's based on a 2012 novel, which is one of my favorite novels. You know, there's like the classics and the greats or whatever, and then there's kind of more modern. And I think just like for our society, the story it told and just hit me personally is one of my favorites. I actually, when I was thinking about it this week, couldn't find my copy, so I ran to Half Price Books and got another one. I'm going to reread it because it's just so good. But basically, it tells the story of this guy in the Bravo company who become stars. And it's really a book about our current kind of wars and these series of wars. But they're in Iraq, and there happens to be an embed Fox News journalist. And so they become heroes, right? They, you know, it's like this 3.5-minute firefight. But they become heroes, and there's wounded, and there's killed, and there's silver stars and bronze stars, and they really truly are these American heroes. But it's less about just like a military book, and it's more a little bit about the absurdity of our culture's kind of fetishization of the military. And they kind of it's a scathing satire in a lot of ways of Texas, of Republicans, of Americans, of not just Republicans. There are military worshippers across the spectrum, but this kind of Fox News idea of just like, well, he's a patriot. And you know, I want to tout my credentials a little bit here. I mean, I own multiple shirts with either Eagles or the Declaration of Independence printed on them. So, I mean, I am a patriot, my friends. You know, if I had to go down the list and name the greatest patriots, you have Uncle Sam, you have Landon Donovan. You know, I don't know exactly Teddy where Roosevelt. I fall in that. Yeah, Dennis Haysbert's character from 24, but you know it's somewhere in I rank somewhere in there. I mean, I grew up playing soccer on base, where I stopped and saluted when they play the national anthem at 5 p.m. every day. Like, it's ingrained deeply in me, this nationalism. But yeah, I also see the folly in it and how ridiculous it is in the book, just so perfectly. And it's also set in Dallas, so these people come back and they are going on this halftime show to celebrate them. And it's so utterly ridiculous. This is based on something that actually happened. It's Thanksgiving, and they're at the halftime show of this nationally televised game, and Destiny's Child is performing in front of them. And the soldiers are like in the back, like, you know, Ken dolls, like basically standing there. It's so ridiculous. But, you know, Jerry Jones and Bush and wanted to drum up support for this fledgling war. So anyway, so this book was beloved, and now they're coming out with a film, and it's coming out on Veterans Day, which I'll be interested to see how scathing and satirical the movie is. But it's directed by Ang Lee, which the guy makes some best pictures. You know, he's got a couple to his name.
Other than Hulk.
That's true. I mean, I was looking at his IMDb. I mean, he pretty much kills it. Like, he kind of burst on the scene with Crouching Tiger, Sense and Sensibility. Good chick flick. But Brokeback Mountain, and he's pretty much been solid and can go either way. But the cast also was pretty incredible. So it's like a nobody who they're introducing to do it, but they also have, they brought Steve Martin basically out of retirement, who's going to play Jerry Jones effectively.
Perfect.
The owner. Yeah. The owner, Norm Oglesby, is just this, like,
why did you lead with that? I have 100% in now.
Yeah,
you could have stopped so talking there it is. After Steve Martin playing Jerry Jones.
So that's the story. Yeah, there it is. But no, Garrett Hedlund, who's just, you know, this fantastic actor and been in a lot of things, is like the leader of the platoon and is a great character in the book, is written. And then Vin Diesel plays like this big, brooding, like, you know, like jarhead, meathead, who's perfect for Vin Diesel. Also, Chris Tucker, who did Rush Hour 3 in 2007. And then I think he did something, I was looking at his IMDb earlier, he did something in like 2011, and that was it. He hasn't done a movie since like 2011. It's like 2 semi-retirements ended for this film. It's got to be good. It also has Kristen Stewart, so we'll see how that goes. We'll bring in the fans. And then, see, there's someone else I thought. But anyways, so just a solid cast with a great director and just this fantastic premise. I think this could be really good. I'm keeping, I hate when I love a book and it becomes a movie and it never lives up, but this cast makes me think, like, this might be good. This might be really good. And I like that they got, like, a new actor who's being introduced in this role to play Billy Lynn, the main character. So it could be really good. I'd keep an eye out for that. Don't sleep on that.
Mine, I kind of have two. The first is, over the weekend, I saw Nice Guys, which is the latest movie by Shane Black. And I would recommend it. I thought it was a really good movie. It's not Kiss Kiss Bang Bang by any stretch of the imagination. Not many movies are, to say the least. But Ryan Gosling is so good in it. He's so perfect in this kind of role. Russell Crowe has really find kind of his home as this kind of, you know, messy, down and out guy that he's been playing lately. So I thought it was a really good movie. I'd recommend seeing it. I know it's, you know, it's out there, and so it's not really off the mainstream, but definitely Nice Guys I recommend seeing. My real thing to not sleep on is Peaky Blinders, which the third season of Peaky Blinders is set to release on Netflix on May the 31st. And I thought this was a bigger show than maybe it is. I've talked to lots of people about this show, and they all say, you know, I have no idea what you're talking about. I make Peaky Blinder jokes about haircuts, and no one seems to know what I'm talking about. So apparently this is not as big a show as it deserves to be. It's a period piece. It's set in 1919 Birmingham, England, right after World War I. It follows this group of gangsters. They're called the Peaky Blinders because they sew razor blades into the brims of their hats, and they use those to fight. And you get to see that pretty early in season one, which is interesting. The leader of the gang is played by Cillian Murphy, who is an excellent actor. The inspector that's really going after them is played by Sam Neill. Sam Neill. I mean, they have in season two, they have a story arc that Tom Hardy, a pretty big story arc that Tom Hardy's involved in. I don't know if he's in season three, but he is definitely in season two for a while. And then there are also some people in this show that when you see them, you're going to recognize who they were. People like Helen McCrory, Paul Anderson, Ido Goldberg, who you'll see their faces and you'll say, oh, I know those people. It's a great cast. It's a great story. There are two seasons, but each season's only six episodes long, so it's a really quick watch if you want to catch up before the 31st, and I would recommend it. I think it's a great show. It's a great period kind of gangster show, and I love it, so make sure you go and check it out if you've not watched it.
Love it.
All right, so that's it for us. Thank you so much, Kyle, for coming on and sharing your one deep nerd love with us. I'm sure we'll have you on again after the season's over. And then we need to have a really deep tinfoil theory dive at some point in the future. So definitely be seeing Kyle again. You can follow him on Twitter at Kyle Carpenter. I make sure you do that, especially if you like basketball or the Spurs. He writes about them pretty regularly and he does great work. Or the Longhorns. Are you still doing pregamer stuff for the Longhorns?
Make Texas great again. Yeah. No Texas Longhorns here. That's another podcast. But yes, read it. Barking Carnival.
If the pregame or the Barking Carnival, if you should read it just for the roster, look ahead, which is and not just because we're friends. That's my favorite thing I read all week during the football season. It is magical. And so make sure.
Kyle's penchant for puns has not seen higher use than the rosters.
It is.
I think there was once an opponent named Judge Juan Snow, like J A J U A N Snow, or it may not have been Snow, but it very quickly lent itself to this podcast. So the jokes write themselves. But yeah, I'll take some credit. Thank you.
No, it's really great. So make sure you check all that out. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at RM Summerlin. You can find Gerald on Twitter at GH Goodridge. We also have a Twitter for the podcast that we've still not done anything with at Two Woke Nerds. You can follow that too. Wherever you find us, make sure that you subscribe and you rate and you review. That really helps. It helps other people find it. It helps us in the rankings. So if you're listening to the show, you've liked it, make sure you do that. And until next week, stay woke.
Stay woke, guys.
Stay woke.